Mehr als freundlich. Der Podcast zum Williams-Beuren-Syndrom. Mit Professor Ingolf Prosetzky und spannenden Gästen und interessanten Geschichten zum WBS.
Welcome to the podcast Williams-Beuren-Syndrom More Than Friendly. The podcast is in German, but for international guests, I always upload the original talk in English in addition to the translated version. I had the following conversation with developmental psychologist and Williams syndrome expert Professor Joe van Herwegen from the University College London. If you enjoy this episode, please feel free to recommend it and subscribe the podcast. In the show notes, you will find the contact information. Now have enjoyment and inspiration while listening. Hi everyone and welcome to my guest. I'd have had to invent the superpower woman term, even if it hadn't been coined yet. She's a developmental psychology and education professor at University College London, one of the world's most prestigious universities. She is active in research networks and was most recently a fellowship at the International Brain Education Fellow for Learning Sciences at UNESCO. She has published so many research articles and book chapters, and she's been conducting research on Williams syndrome for many, many years, particularly in mathematics and academic learning, so about the lifespan. Above all, she's interested in applying her knowledge, which is really inspiring. She's Education Needs Advisory for the UK Williams Syndrome Foundation and writes blogs for families and schools. And by the way, she's very open, curious and interested colleague who supports young colleagues and approaches others and is very available in cooperation. And by the way, you are...
Oh, so many nice words. It's difficult to listen to.
the mother of two young, wonderful children. So welcome and thank you so much for taking the time for us, Professor Dr. Joe van Herwegen.
Thank you so much, Ingo, for having me.
Before we start talking about Williams syndrome and your research and you as a person and what you're doing professionally, I have one request. I would like to ask you to make a typical noise for your professional activities or maybe from your private life.
Oh, so a noise that represents it?
Yes.
Okay, I've got one. It would be a big whoosh. My mum always used to say to me, when Joe's in the house, you can feel the air change. You know, it's like a high pressure. Let's go.
Yeah, let's start with a question about your childhood. Did you want to be a scientist when you were a child?
Oh, what a tricky question. No, not really. Oh, I wanted to do many things. I think I never could make up my mind. There was a time I wanted to be an architect. There was a time that I wanted to be an actress. I did want to become a psychologist, and in Belgium, when you're 18, you get some advice from a counselor in terms of what to do. And they said, because you're not very good at maths, Joe, I don't think you can become a psychologist. When I started at university, I studied linguistics and not psychology, because the idea was that my mathematical abilities weren't strong enough.
I know you're originally from Belgium and you studied in Antwerp. How did you end up as a professional researcher in the UK?
When I was studying, it was in my final year of my master's in linguistics, and I had to do a dissertation. And one of the professors asked whether I could do a literature review on Williams syndrome, because he was moving to the US to do research on Williams syndrome. For him, it was also a kind of a condition he hadn't heard of before. And as I was writing, I was reading over the summer and writing this essay over the summer, I became really interested in this idea that you have children who are very verbal and very fluent often, yet have comprehension difficulties and have difficulties in other areas in terms of cognition and development. And I wanted to know more. And this was back in the 90s. And the names that came appearing on the papers were, you know, Annette Carmel of Smith and Ursula Bellucci. And so I wanted to know more. And I don't know why. I wrote a letter to Annette Carmel of Smith saying, I would love to learn more. You don't have to pay me, but I'd like to come and work with you for a few weeks. And she, of course, you know, thought free labor, we're not going to turn that down. So I was allowed to come to her lab, visit her lab. And I stayed with at the lab at the Institute of Child Health for about 4 weeks and learned a lot about psychology and, you know, how to do research. But then I went back to Belgium to finish my my master's and my dissertation. And she rang me back a couple of months later saying that she urgently needed a researcher. And because I was already familiar with the lab, and this was not on Williams syndrome, it was with very young babies, she thought that I would be a good person for that role. And what was supposed to be a part-time 6-month position in London became a 22-year career, and I never went back to Belgium. So, and then did another master's in to learn more about psychology, and then worked as a researcher for a few years, and then my PhD finally. So, yes, it was not a planned journey, but it all started with Williams syndrome.
And today, some 20 years after you came to London, a lot more knowledge about the strengths and weaknesses of Williams syndrome has been gathered thanks to further developments in research. What would you say in general about how children and adults with Williams syndrome learn over the lifespan? So what are typical challenges and strengths?
Yes, there's quite a few differences. I think one of the things that maybe is often overlooked is that children with Williams syndrome learn but are on their own trajectory. And by that I mean is we know that many children are delayed in their development, and that starts especially with motor development and also with their language development, even though later on it becomes a strength. They often start off with delays, so we don't see first words appearing at the age of 1, which is what we usually see in typically developing children. So we see that motor development is a very early on in infancy is a difficulty, and that has kind of cascading effects on development over time. So that means that over time, their language development is delayed, but then we see that there's a catch-up for language. However, for other abilities like physiospatial abilities, so how children orientate themselves in space, or how they complete puzzles, we see that that's a significant difficulty. And that difficulty kind of remains over time. So yeah, so we can kind of see that language is a strength and visuospatial abilities are difficulties, but we see other difficulties as well. We often refer to it as the uneven cognitive profiles. If we even think about memory, for example, we see that often children or individuals with Williams syndrome might get easily distracted, might not be able to recall information if they have to do it backwards, for example, so using their working memory. Yet, if it's their area of interest, they can recall many facts and learn a lot. You know, we know that some individuals with Williams syndrome might have specific interest in Hoovers or airplanes or trains. And then we see that they can recall a lot of information about these particular areas of interest.
What do you think, what are the causes of learning problems, and what are the causes for the wide range of learning options? I mean, you know, there's a wide range within syndrome differences. One explanation is often it's a genetic thing, or maybe we can explain it with genetical aspects. What is your view on it?
It's a great question, Ingolf. I think we mustn't forget that although, you know, there is a genetic deletion in Williams syndrome, and that, you know, one of the main deletions is often ELN, and that codes for elastic, and this can explain some of the motor difficulties very early onwards. But on top of the genes, we also know that the environment plays a very important role, and that development is the outcome of this gene and environment interaction. And what that means for individuals with Williams syndrome is, if you think, for example, about learning, is yes, you might be delayed from in your motor development, but with stimulation by sitting up, by walking, children are able to explore their environment in a different way and therefore are able to learn. many children with Williams syndrome are on a different trajectory because of this gene-environment interaction, whether it's early intervention, but of course also, you know, some children have more significant delays than others that are genetic, and therefore it might be, you know, that's why there's so many different developmental trajectories, if that makes sense. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
it's a very tricky subject. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to individuals with Williams syndrome, because it's a rare genetic condition, we are at a moment in London, we have a database which we call the Wisdom database, which is the first longitudinal database in Europe for individuals with Williams syndrome. And we're trying, using that database, to understand where individual differences come from, how important early intervention is, what kind of interventions work best. But it is because it's a rare genetic condition, and to answer these very important questions around gene-environment interactions, you need a lot of data points. We're still in the infancy in trying to understand these individual differences and what these developmental trajectories really look like. But early intervention, especially in terms of motor development, in terms of language development, are very important. We see that young children with Williams syndrome, for example, don't point so much. Again, it's a motor activity. And that, of course, has cascading effects on their language development. In typically developing children will point a lot, and parents will then, you know, point out the words that go with where they're pointing at, making that learning between pointing and attention and the word that they hear a lot easier. So, you know, these kind of interventions on motor development, language development early on, are then setting these children on the right path to develop further. Because development really is, it starts with what we call domain general abilities like motor and language. And then later on, you've got visuospatial and memory abilities. And all of these have an impact on learning. So it's not just like one thing. It's kind of all these abilities need to come together and need to become integrated.
You have already repeatedly named the term development, and I know that it plays an important role for you. I'll cite from your homepage, "I believe that it's important to study abilities from infancy onwards in order to obtain a better understanding of how cognitive abilities develop over time and how performances across different cognitive areas related to each other." Can you please explain once more, or in other words, why development is such an important term or an idea from your point of view?
Development is important because we often think that because children have a specific condition, that they won't change over time. And what our research shows is that individuals with Williams syndrome continue to learn even beyond when they're 18 years old. So we don't see kind of any plateau effects. So many children...
Could you explain what you mean with plateau effects?
So plateau effect would be when we don't see any more development. So whether I'm going to use mathematical development maybe as an example. So we know that a lot of children with Williams syndrome have problems with learning mathematics. Yes, they are able to count, but really understanding what counting is for, or doing simple sums, addition, subtraction, can often be quite challenging. However, what we see is that even in adulthood, we see an improvement and continuous improvement. It's not like, oh, at some point, children stop learning. Children don't stop learning. Individuals don't stop learning. Adults don't stop learning. We still see development after they're aged 18. And I think that's quite an interesting finding in terms of how we see education for adults with conditions such as Williams syndrome. Because in Germany, but in the UK, there aren't many learning opportunities after they are going to college. Like college is something to the age of 18. For some people, it can be all the way up to 25. But what we see is in our research is that there's still learning happening after that point as well. And so there is a question there of, should we continue the support, interventions, therapies, whatever we call it, educational programs for individuals with Williams syndrome, even beyond the point of 25, seeing that learning doesn't stop.
In the 1980s, 90s, and early 2000s, one could sometimes get the impression from the research discussions that there's a relatively simple link between genes and the brain behavior, and that, for example, the social behavior of people with Williams syndrome can be reduced to alternate genes and brains.
Yeah.
In fact, we know now that relationship between genes, brains, and behavior is much more dynamic and complex. Nevertheless, this mechanistic and reductionistic understanding is still powerful today. And you have criticized this in various articles and called this reductionism a neuromyth. What did you mean by that exactly, by a neuromyth?
I think, indeed, often there is the question, and I get this question from parents as well, like, is it important that we know my child's genetic deletion, how wide it is? And if they have a wider deletion, does that mean that they're going to be more significant cognitive concerns or whether learning might be a difficulty? And indeed, the answer to that is no, there isn't a direct link between the size of the deletion or the genetic deletion and the outcomes. Because over development, there is a lot of interaction. The brain changes a lot through it being in the environment. You know, we know that factors such as how well a child sleeps, and that can be related to some of the irritation we see in children, or sensory processing difficulties, or how much a child is able to eat, all impact on how a child is sleeping. We know that sleep is very important for brain development. And so it's these factors over time, such as sleep, eating, environment, interventions that kind of have an impact on brain development so that the outcome can change. So this is what I would sometimes call a neuromyth, the idea that our genes directly impact on our outcomes, on our way of thinking, that everything is static and that there is no change over time. And that's actually not true. There's a lot that happens also in the brains of people with Williams syndrome or other conditions. You know, there is development. We know that in the brain, there is pruning of connections. So if there's something part of our brain or that we don't use for a while, the connections between the cells in those areas, they don't fire as quickly anymore, or we might lose connections. At the same time, when we practice something, then, you know, we get new connections. And the more we practice something, the more the connections between different parts in our brain get stronger, and it becomes easier in terms of thinking and using those brain cells to do some things. So neuromyths are related to these ideas that things are static.
And what do you think should teachers and the persons who work in kindergarten know about brain development to work with Williams, with children, or with pupils and adults with Williams syndrome? What do you think, or which kind of advices are you give to schools?
Yeah, oh, there's a lot of advice. As you know, together with Finola Tinan, we've written some educational guidelines for teachers. They're on the Williams Syndrome Foundation website in England. We've now also just developed a short course for teachers, which is completely online. It's in English, unfortunately, in the UK, where we kind of try to give teachers the basic in terms of understanding what happens, you know, how does learning happen in individuals with Williams syndrome. And I think there's a couple of things that are very important for learning. And this goes back to a book that Stanislas Dehaene has written in terms of, you know, he's really a prominent researcher in brain development. And he would say there's four pillars. And the first pillar of that is attention. And if a child is not paying attention, then of course a child will not be able to learn. You know, there's the kind of the first thing to happen is to have attention. And we know that children with Williams syndrome can be distracted or more easily distracted. Some children love looking at faces because that's what their brain likes as a kind of stimuli. When a child is looking at a teacher and the teacher is explaining something, children with Williams syndrome may not always be paying attention to what the teacher is saying. They might be looking at the teacher's face but not really be able to take in the information. Other aspects that might detract attention is the sensory processing difficulties. So we know that some children with Williams syndrome need more input in order for their brain to register it. That might be speaking in a louder voice. That might be giving them tactile sensory toys so that, you know, their sensory senses are settled and they can learn. Might be about avoiding distracting noise, background noise. I've seen it many times in the classroom that, you know, a child with Williams syndrome is distracted because there is a lawnmower outside or the postman is delivering something or there's an airplane and they get distracted. And that means that, you know, so I think the first important thing for learning for a child with Williams syndrome is that they can pay attention. Sometimes that might mean learning in a one-to-one setting so the teacher can carefully monitor where is the child with Williams syndrome looking, what are they doing. And secondly, it's the language. Have they understood what they need to do? And breaking the steps down. I speak very fast. I know that. And that's very difficult for a child to learn from because there is so much information to process. And we know that children with Williams syndrome often have working memory difficulties. So the ability to hold information in mind and to do something with that information, the processing of that information. And so it's, I think, especially in England, the curriculum of what needs to be taught to children at any level, whether it's primary or secondary school level, is very fast. And often that's too fast for children with Williams syndrome who need more time to process information. We need also a lot more repetition for these brain connections to be formed, basically. So those would be my three kind of pillars to focus on, you know, is kind of key. If you start with that, you started the right way, which is one, make sure the child is paying attention, not distracted. Make sure that they can understand what they need to do in terms of, and then breaking it down and have lots of repetition. Maybe that's four. See, Ingolf, I'm not very good at math sometimes.
Yeah, I was wondering a bit of it. Now we have four wonderful. it's now complete. Additional to all the information from your view of research, what can families, what can parents do to support their children if they are young? If they are in school, and definitely what to do, which inputs they can give if they are older after school?
Oh, it's a very difficult question, Ingolf, that, you know, I'll need to think. Well, one thing is this kind of repetition. And, I'm a parent myself. The way teachers teach things at school now is quite different from how I was taught maths or how I was taught reading. And so I think having a very good communication with the school, understanding what the child has done during that day, understanding how they teach addition, how they teach reading through a whole word approach, like here is the word and that's what it means, or is it through this phonics approach where children learn the sound and what the letter correspondence of that is, so that parents can then at home reuse those words, maybe have another go at one maths, you know, activity. Reading is very important, book reading, thinking about vocabulary. We know that pre-learning helps a lot. So again, that's for all children with special needs. So having kind of already an idea of what a child is going to be taught during the week so that the parents can use that vocabulary and explain it. Again, is because children with Williams syndrome need a lot of repetition and learn, you know, it's how they can help them. Now, of course...
I'm sorry, Joe, could you say once more, what do you understand as... pre-learning, what does it mean?
Pre-learning is so that the child goes to school and they've already know a little bit about the topic or the words that they're going to be learning about, and it's because then it makes it easier for them to make the connections. A lot of the time, you're very good at this, Ingolf, I've used words and you ask me what does that mean, but children in a classroom often don't do that. And so a child then will come to school, will be asked to do something, will not understand what they need to do, and they're already starting a little bit being behind, if that makes sense. Whereas if parents know that their child is going to do addition for the first time and can already explain what is addition at home or talk about particular topics, so that the child comes to school and is able to pick up already some information like, oh yeah, I know what that means. We've talked about it at home. We know that that helps children so that they don't come to school and there's a lot of information to process and a lot of new words or new things to cope with. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, this needs to be done at a intensive way. The learning will happen at school. One parent once said to me, if I can make my child already do one of the maths activities at home the day before, only one, I know that my child will get another one at school. You know, it doesn't mean doing lots of things at home, just introducing a few words or doing one maths activity or reading a book or watching a film about a particular topic can already help children in their pre-learning, if it may.
Okay. And I know that you did already research in the field or according to the transition process from primary to secondary school or other transition processes. What did you learn in your research about this process and which tips could you advise to families, to pupils with Williams syndrome and of course to the staff of the school?
Oh, yes. That was a really interesting project because we asked parents before school transition and after school transition what they thought, what they worried about, what they thought was going to happen. We asked teachers of children with Williams syndrome and Down syndrome, as well as autistic individuals. And we also asked the young people themselves who were transitioning from primary to secondary school before they transitioned and after they transitioned. And one of the things that's really interesting from that research is that what children are worried about is very different to what parents are worried about. And what was even more interesting is it hadn't occurred to teachers that children would be worried about, where do I go to the toilet? Where am I going to have my lunch? What happens when I become sick, when I'm not feeling well? Where do I go? Who would be in my classroom? So if you think about the information we give students when they go from primary to secondary school, it often is information about, this will be your school uniform. This is, you know, what you're going to be learning. This is what's expected from you from your learning. But actually what the young people themselves needed was very practical information. Who's going to be in my class? So the question is, could there already be some visits to the school so that the young people get to know other young people who will be in their classroom? Because that kind of relieves the anxiety a little bit around going to secondary school. We also found that, you know, they wanted a map of their school so that they can learn to kind of what is where in my school. And we know maps don't always work well for individuals with Williams syndrome, but, you know, through photos of the school, learn what is where in my new school. And very practical things like, what do I do when I get ill? So one parent had done a fantastic job by making a very individualized book for her child about moving to the new school. And the book had information in there about, you know, who are we saying goodbye to? Where are we going? And how are you going to get there? So she had taken pictures of the new route to school. She had taken pictures of my new school. She had put in there, where will you go to the toilet? What is your daily routine like when you go to new school? And during the summer holidays, every time her child got a bit anxious about, you know, my new school. And as you know, when individuals with Williams syndrome get anxious, they sometimes ask the same questions repeatedly. The mother would just say, go and look at your book, your transition book. And the child found that transition book so helpful in terms of with visual pictures, being able to understand this is what's going to happen in September when I go to my new school.
Do you have any ideas according to the communication between school staff and parents?
That's another very good one. Yes, so it's in England that really depends a lot on the school. Of course, when we do research with families who have children with Williams syndrome, they live all over England and of course across many different school districts, and every school district works slightly differently. So in some schools, there was a lot of communication with the parents and there were a lot of visit days. Some children had up to 5 visits to their new school so that there was a good understanding of what the new school looked like, who the teachers were. And so there was a lot of communication between the parent and the teacher. But what is really interesting, where there's a lack or a gap in terms of communication, is between the teachers from the primary school and the teachers from the secondary school. And we often say, and actually it also happens within schools, is that what is the continuity of teaching? In my experience, what happens is a child goes to a new classroom and the teacher needs to learn about how does this child function? How does this child with Williams syndrome learn? Is it, you know, what works best for this child? How long can they concentrate for? What have they learned already? Where are the gaps in the learning that we need to fill? And then the teacher learns through trial and error about what works, what doesn't work. And maybe halfway through the year, they get it right. And you see an increase in learning. The problem then is in June or in July, depending on the country, the school finishes, the child goes through the next year and the process starts all over again. So I think in for children with Williams syndrome, there's often a learning gap because this relationship between the teacher needs to be worked out. And I think this can be kind of resolved by having a stronger communication between the teachers when children transition from one year to another or from primary school to secondary school, to really talk about, you know, I've worked with this child and what works really well is teaching this child first through music. Or what works really well is if I do 5 minutes one-to-one with this child first before the rest of the class comes in, then I know the child is already ahead and is able to learn within the wider classroom settings. Those kind of the techniques, the practices that teachers have that they know work are not necessarily communicated to the teacher who will be teaching the next year or in secondary school. So there's not this continuity of teaching practice, basically.
Joe, I know it's not an easy question, but I ask it anyway. What can you suggest to parents when they feel that there isn't a good communication with the school? I know there are always, of course, extremes. On one hand, you have parents who are never satisfied with the school, who have extremely high expectation of the teacher. And in Germany, we also call them helicopter parents because they want to watch and have control of everything. And the other extreme is the parents who want or can't take care of their children. And they don't know what's going on at school. But between these two extremes, I mean, the most parents are between them. What could you suggest for the most of them? Do you have any ideas about what these parents could do to help to improve a better communication?
It's a difficult area, isn't it? Because in England as well, teachers are very overworked at the moment and you know, they have a lot of preparation to do. As I said, the curriculum is quite dense. There's a lot in it to cover. One of the things we argue for is, and we also say this in the book, at the end of the book, we have an information sheet that should be quite quick for teachers to complete. It's a piece of paper that parents can photocopy and can take on a daily basis. And it's just a teacher just ticks around what went well and what didn't go so well. So it doesn't take a long time for the teacher to communicate with the parent in terms of what the child had done that day, what worked well, what didn't work well. And then at the bottom, there is just one box that teachers can complete if there's something specific that they want to say. And I would suggest that parents, it sounds bad, but in England, often parents have to make that book themselves and send it to the child and have the agreements and to say with the teacher, can you complete this? It takes literally 2 minutes to complete, but it tells the parent a lot around what has the child done in the school, what happened, were there any incidents? Because again, when things happen on the playground or when there's been a little incident, often children with Williams syndrome can't tell what happened to them, if that makes sense. And so I know that parents rely a lot on the information that teachers give them about how their child's day was. I can ask my 10-year-old who doesn't have Williams syndrome, what did you do in school today? And I might, we don't always get a lot of information from our children anyway, but I might be able, if something happened, he will tell me, whereas that is not a given for children with Williams syndrome in terms of them telling parents what they've done, what they liked, what they didn't like. And sometimes it's also difficult to really understand what really happened, you know, what were the details. So,
yeah, my boys are always answer, good. How was it? Okay. Oh, good. In school.
It so, doesn't give us much to go.
Then we can play good cop or bad cop and we get more information from it. So I have one last question to the complex of general learning or cognitive development across the lifespan. I see a big gap between in the Williams, the VS research field between research for younger and school age and the adults. Could you say anything to that? Why we don't have so less, can I say it, so less research for adults with Williams syndrome?
It's something that really resonates. We've just finished a study that was published this summer. The report is out now. It's called Shape Research, Change Lives. And that was a project with Professor Emily Farren and Professor Gaia Sharif, who also do research on Williams syndrome, and then Professor Liz Pelicano. In that research, we looked at priorities. What are the priorities of the funders who fund our research? What are the priorities of the researchers? And what are the priorities of the stakeholders? And that's, we call them the parents of individuals with Williams syndrome, the young people who with Williams syndrome themselves. And indeed, there is a lot of questions more around, I think funders and researchers thus far have looked at what is Williams syndrome from a medical point of view, from a cognitive development point of view, and that we're only now just starting to see, okay, now we need to ask questions around, now that we know more about the development in Williams syndrome from a cognitive point of view. I wouldn't even say brain point of view because we know very little about brain development in Williams syndrome. And a little bit more about the medical side, although even again in the medical side, there's huge gaps where there's areas we don't know a lot in terms of their medical well-being. But there is a little bit now, a change happening to, right now, let's look at interventions, what works. And again, you know, we're at the starting point of that. So a lot of focus is on the young children. But I do think that with the reports and the recommendations of the report, I really hope that there will be more research looking at what works for adults with Williams syndrome. The only problem is that there's an issue in England and the wider UK around provision. So we know that a lot of young people with Williams syndrome are out of employment. Finding a job is a difficulty. For them to live individually when they're an adult is very difficult. There aren't many opportunities because of the social network not being there. And I think that kind of explains why there's a gap in the research as well, because it's not there. So what is there to research? We can't say how well does something work when there is at the moment no provision. So I'm hoping it will change. Because I think, you know, our research clearly shows from a cognitive development point of view, development continues to happen in adulthood as well. But that when it comes to intervention, support, I'm thinking employability, well-being over time, there is definitely a lot more research that needs to happen, you know, around adults with Williams syndrome.
Thank you. I would like to go now to the point math, which you said that is not your strong side, but you are currently the leading expert in mathematical abilities in Williams syndrome. What could you tell us about mathematical learning and the conditions of Williams syndrome? What does work good? What doesn't work so well? And where can teachers and or parents start to support them to learn how to manage their money, for example?
Yes, no, it's very important. So we know that children with Williams syndrome are quite good at counting, right? So if you ask them to count, you know, they'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, no problem there. Counting onwards as well. digit recognition, not a problem. But what we do see is that understanding what counting is for, what we call cardinality, is a difficulty. So the difficulty in Williams syndrome is that they are able to count to four, but might not understand what four really is. It's four objects and no more than four and no less than four. The other difficulty they have is understanding how numbers relate to each other. The order of numbers, 6, 7, 8, but also more importantly, how four relates to 14. It's a different four. And 40, again, has another different, the four in that means something different as well. So it's that kind of understanding how numbers relate to each other. We often think numbers along a line, think of numbers as a tape measure, and it will help us then. So we know that using number lines, so in England, in schools, children often get like a piece of paper, which like a tape measure. And when they're doing sums or subtraction, they keep that tape measure in front of them. They can use that tape measure to count upwards or downwards if they have to do addition or subtraction. But very often, this is where children with Williams syndrome, because then becomes a visuospatial aspect as well, right? So it's kind of learning to know, oh, if I do addition, I need to go up the number line. If I do subtraction, I need to go down the number line. So children need to be explicitly taught how to use the number line. I think for children with Williams syndrome, the mathematical development are understanding what numbers mean and how they relate to each other. And we also know that they have problems with working memory. And working memory is this ability to hold information in line, two numbers, and then you have to do something with that information, like adding it up. And that all takes mental capacity, basically. So, and this is why we know that children with Williams syndrome benefit from manipulatives. Anything that can help them with their working memory, whether it's counting on your fingers, whether it's, you know, using marbles, for example, to do additions to help them. Parents can help children also by teaching children with Williams syndrome tricks. Tricks sounds bad, but I mean it in a good way. By using their long-term memory, which is quite good. So I don't know if you're familiar with like number bonds, which is, you know, number 10 can be made out up from 1 and 9, but 2 and 8, 3 and 7, 4 and 6, and 2 fives. This is something that children can learn through, you know, repetition. So it becomes easier when children are doing addition to know, oh, if I've got 3 and, you know, I've got another 7, oh, that makes 10. Learning what makes 10 can be very helpful. And there was something else and now I've forgotten it. But anyway, those are the kind of key things parents can do with teaching their children mathematics. It takes a lot of repetition. This is how children will learn what numbers mean through this kind of visual representation, manipulatives. Oh, that was the other thing I was going to say. Teaching a child that one hand has got 5 fingers. Your hand's got 5 fingers. My hand's got 5 fingers. 2 hands make 10 fingers. Will help again with children processing mathematical abilities and doing sums. And that in the end will help children understand the value of money. Because at the moment we can teach them this is 100 euros, but it doesn't have any meaning to them. We've been doing some work. This is a program that was developed by a parent who has a young person with Down syndrome, and it's called the Maths for Life program. We're now evaluating how it works for people with other conditions or general special educational needs. What is different in the Maths for Life program is that, one, it uses a lot of manipulatives. 2, it's very scaffolded, so you don't move on to the next thing without a child being able to do the previous step. So if you wouldn't go on to do addition if they still don't know what are the numbers in order from 1 to 10, for example. But also importantly is to teach them through examples. A good example is talking about time. Many children with Williams syndrome have problems understanding time, right? So what is 5 minutes? What is 10 minutes? What's an hour? And you can explain that much more concretely for children through saying, well, I don't know if it's in Germany very big, but in England we have Peppa Pig, which is a popular TV program for young children, and it only lasts 5 minutes. And children have a really good understanding how long that is because they've watched them and they're always 5 minutes. So you can tell your child in terms of time, it's one Peppa Pig long. No, it's two Peppa Pig longs. But of course, an hour is much longer. An hour is more like a film for young children. By teaching children through these kind of concrete examples, and for money, it could be something like, well, no, that's the value of a piece of bread. I don't know what the price of a piece of bread is at the moment in Europe, but I assume it's, you know, 2 to 3 euros, right? So that is 2 to 3 euros. But a car is very expensive. And teaching children around, you know, that's like buying a car, which is a lot of money. And this is more like buying a piece of loaf, or this is like one Peppa Pig, and this is more like a film, will help children with Williams syndrome to get to the understanding of what numbers really mean.
Okay, yeah, thank you for all the ideas. I could add the option of a digital learning. I know a father from is Thomas Dubiel. He lives in Dresden, close here to Görlitz, and he created an app for math. And he said that he was really surprised that his boy were so focused and could deal with that and could learn with a different kind of as a medium.
But I can imagine that the app is also it's very visual. It's concrete, and it allows a lot of repetition. And these are kind of the key aspects of learning for people with Williams syndrome.
Yeah, thank you for all the tips. I would like to go back or forward to the topic of research. You are so long in this field. Do you know how many people with Williams syndrome you have already talked to or seen?
Oh, that's a tricky question. Not really. So I still run a clinic for children with Williams syndrome where I assess them and then write reports to help the parents with the, you know, in England, we have education, health and care plans. So these reports go through that. So I know with those ones, I see about 30 or more than 30 children per year. And if we look at our database, I think we've got over 400 people with Williams syndrome in there. And I think I've seen all of them at some point. And some of them I've seen over 6 or 8 times. So, yeah, quite a few people.
Oh, wow. And what did you learn from individuals with Williams syndrome and maybe their families? First, maybe on the research side and on the private side.
Yeah, no, thank you. So many different things. I think on the research side, I still love the fact that I can or have the opportunity to really work with children with Williams syndrome because I've learned that it's important not to see what they can and cannot do, but how they do things, because that has often triggered new questions for me. And I often children with Williams syndrome will do something, but will do things differently. So we're now hoping to start a new project, for example, that is completely driven by something that I observed. And then actually another parent mentioned it to me as well, which was we often see that children with Williams syndrome can do something and then it seems like they forget it. And then later on, they can do it again. It kind of made me think that learning is not a linear trajectory, basically. But we don't know much about what does that trajectory of learning look like? You know, what are the ups and downs and how many repetitions does it take for a child with Williams syndrome to really know something? So we're now putting some funding together to really look at this kind of what does learning look like in Williams syndrome in terms of how many repetitions does it need? And that comes from children themselves. From a more personal note, I think it's more about I know how hard in England parents need to fight to get support for their child that they need. But I also have learned that working or having a child with Williams syndrome enriches people. You look at things through, you know, a new way. There is a lot of love and a lot of pleasure and they're very witty. I mean, children with Williams syndrome often make me smile because of the things they say or what their curiosity is absolutely amazing. I mean, I love that about young people with Williams syndrome is their curiosity. So I think, you know, there's a lot of positives there to learn from as well.
How can we make the voices and opinions of individuals with Williams syndrome be even more heard? You already mentioned the example of asking children before they leave from primary to secondary school. Do you have any other ideas for schools, and what can we do in the area of research?
I think in terms of schools, we sometimes underestimate children with Williams syndrome in that they're very capable to say what they'd like. I always ask them, what would you like to do when you grow up? And I think it's a very important question, because I do know that people with Williams syndrome, or some of them at least, will be able to hold a job, live to some extent independently with support. And I think sometimes children with Williams syndrome get underestimated in what they could do. And that's why it's important to listen to their voice in terms of what they like, what they don't like, what they need help with, what they don't need help with. We talked about helicopter parents earlier on. You know, sometimes children do no longer need help. They've learned it. They can now do it without support. It's important that we learn to take away the support when it's no longer required. On the other hand, it's also important that we listen more to the voices when it comes to research. As we've spoken about today, Ingolf, it's about listening. What research is needed for parents so that they can support their child, whether they're young or whether these are adults with Williams syndrome? Because they have the lived experience. And I think that means for us researchers listening to, what do you think is next? What are the difficulties? What should we concentrate on so that the research is useful? I also think that means also listening, not only giving a voice to people with Williams syndrome, but also giving a voice to the teachers, the professionals who support people with Williams syndrome, so that we understand more what information do they require to support people with Williams syndrome better.
What current difficulties do you see in the field of Williams research?
Yes.
Which barriers do you have?
Yes, it's so there's a couple of things. We were talking about this the other day. First of all, funding. Because Williams syndrome is a rare genetic condition, you know, the question that funders always ask is, why should we, research is expensive, why should we give money to such a small population? And of course, my answer to that is that because, you know, Williams syndrome matters, but we can also learn a lot from looking at people with different conditions and putting it all together. So funding is a difficulty. But I also know how busy parents are and how busy schools are. And in order for us to do research, it's about getting access to participants who've taken part in our research for many years, but other participants who can't participate because they don't have the time. They can't get to London to take part in our research. We're now also trying to think more as researchers how we can do certain research studies online, remotely, so that, you know, people who don't have the ability to come to London or don't have the time to invest in research as much as others, that they can also have their voices heard in different ways. And contribute to research.
According to this, if you were given a suitcase full of millions, in which area would you put it? I could expect that you would put it in research, but maybe you have other ideas.
It's actually very different. I have thought about this because someone asked me that once, like, if you win the lottery, what would you do? And would you stop doing research? And I said, no, I wouldn't stop doing research. I love research too much. But I would also make sure that we do something differently. And that would be to create more opportunities for individuals with Williams syndrome and Down syndrome and other conditions to be employed. Because what I think is required is to have employers know more about the strengths of people with Williams syndrome and Down syndrome. We so often talk about the difficulties, but not enough about the strengths. I've worked with young people with Williams syndrome. Recently, there was a young person who came to our clinic who is very interested in history and is very good to recall facts and is very sociable. He's verbal. In his town, there is a little museum, and his dream is to go and work in that museum. And I can't imagine any better job for this person people with Williams syndrome are often very sociable. This young person is very sociable, very, you know, no fear of strangers, no fear of speaking in public, and is interested in history. What better tour guide in a museum could you have than that? And I think there are other examples that I've learned over the years, but we don't talk about it maybe a lot. And it's about finding the right match for the right person, if that makes sense. In England, often people with learning disabilities end up stacking shelves in a supermarket. I don't think that's necessarily the right match. It could be a good match for some people, but for other people, there might be other ways. And I would love, if I had a lot of money, to set up agency to do this matching between, well, here you've got a young person, and let's find the right job for this young person, something that they will excel at.
So you said that if you would win in the lottery, you wouldn't stop do research. How do you manage to combine your huge work and research amount of work together with family and private life? what is your superpower? it's a whoosh from the beginning, or what is it?
It's a tricky one. I think when you do something you're really passionate about, and it doesn't feel like work, and that's, I think, is very true. You know, I love that I can do what I like doing. I often get my children involved in research, which is maybe not always the ethical, you know, in terms of, you know, oh, I want to try out a new idea. I've got two subjects at home. Let's try out whether the new idea would work. But I do try and separate, like have time off. I do a lot of running as well. And, you know, I think it's important to spend time away. But I think the most important thing is that you don't have to do research in a particular room. I can go for a run and think about research. I can, on my way to work, you know, I can think about research problems and how to solve them. So I'm trying to be very organized. I'm sometimes failing at it, but I'm trying to be organized.
Yes, Joe. So thank you very much for your time and for the fruitful and inspiring talk with you. And yeah, it's wonderful that you gave us, me and us, so many inputs.
Well, thank you very much, Ingo, for having me and for your very interesting and sometimes also challenging questions. So it was a pleasure to be here.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Das war Mehr als freundlich, der Podcast zum Williams-Beuren-Syndrom mit Professor Ingolf Prosetzky. Wenn dir der Podcast gefällt oder du Fragen und Themenvorschläge hast, schreib eine Nachricht per Mail an podcast@w-b-s.de, poste auf Instagram oder schau dir weitere Infos zur Folge auf der Internetseite an.